Yeah.
I'm always frozen.
Yeah. Yeah, that looks nice.
Okay. Can we start the bow? Great. Well, thank you for being here. I know that some people are disappointed that we didn't have more people or new people, but I think this has been very valuable for the people who have been here, and I think that this group has, you know, our group has a certain camaraderie, and we're going through this course together. You know, it's a journey you're making together. So I don't think we should really be concerned. I mean, it's nice if more people come, but as the Buddha said, there's just as much merit in teaching one person the Dharma as there is in teaching hundreds. So what we're doing here has great merit for all of us. Anyway, and I have very much appreciated the talks. I was here for Roland's talk. I wasn't here for the other ones, but I listened to all of them on the website. I really enjoyed listening to them. I thought that everybody who, Bill and Steve and Eric, all did a really good job, and all of you being willing to, you know, join in the discussion and add your wisdom. So I know our top is equanimity. I have this tendency to always want to begin at the beginning. And so my feeling is the beginning is something touched us, something inspired us to get involved in this path, whatever it was. It was somebody you saw, something you heard. And I like stories, so I love the story about how the Buddha started. I don't know if you've heard this story. Oh, you have?
When he saw suffering outside of the palace.
No, that was when he left the palace. I'm talking about, this is the Buddha, he was a young man, this is like three immeasurable kalpas before he gained enlightenment. Oh, okay. How did he start? How did he start on this path? Aren't you curious about that?
Yeah.
So anyway, he's a little boy in this town, little town. It's very rural. And it was the raining season, so it's very muddy. And there was a Buddha at that time. Pankankara was his name. That was the name of the Buddha. And he was coming to visit this village. And, of course, that was a very exciting thing. You can imagine how people felt. And this little boy was very mischievous, and, you know, he just was off on his own, doing his own thing, and the Buddha's coming, he's not paying attention. Yeah. So anyway, it's a muddy season, and the Buddha's coming, and everybody is bringing rugs and things to put down for the Buddha to walk on over this muddy path. And so, you know, this little boy's mother grabs him and says, "You have to come." So he gets there, and everybody's putting these things down. He doesn't have anything to put down, so he lays down. And the Buddha steps over him and looks down on him with such loving kindness. And the little boy looks up at him and he goes, "I want to be like that. I want to be like that." And that was how he started on the path. And he, you know, practiced what's called the path of inference, which is the Mahayana path versus Vajrayana path, which takes a really long time. But it's supposed to be very stable when you attain enlightenment. So there was something that each of us, I don't even know if you can remember what it was, but something inspired you to start, and you started sitting, and and practicing and listening and reading, etc. And you started to, I guess, started to feel a little bit of settling down, a little bit of opening up, a little bit of curiosity of where is this going, some beginning to lighten up, maybe. The Vijayadhara is very clear when he says that the shamatha practice, one of the reasons we do shamatha practice is to make friends with ourselves. That's one of the main reasons for doing shamatha. For letting go of our blaming ourselves, or feeling bad about ourselves, or whatever it is, and starting to, you know, have some sort of appreciation, at least sometimes. From that, we also develop some sort of awareness of not only how our minds work, but how the world works, but also awareness in terms of having a bigger view. And just like what Carol was saying earlier about going out into the world and noticing other people and how they are, and that's a product of our practice and our contemplation. So we begin to see a bigger picture outside of ourselves, and we're curious about that too. And so then we continue. And how many of you have taken the Bodhisattva vow? What were you thinking? Do you know what you signed up for?
I almost didn't go through with it.
Yeah.
Huh? I almost didn't go through with it.
Yeah. It's understandable. I mean, we signed up to be a bridge and a ladder and, you know, all of these things that it says in the Bodhisattva Vitara. To be of benefit to all sentient beings. Regardless, it's a big commitment. And, you know, at this point, if we're honest with ourselves, we aspire to be that. You know, we aspire to be that. And so part of doing this kind of practice is to work with that aspiration, to work with that intention. Like I said, I really think that the Four Immeasurables are part of the Lojong, like Tonglen, part of the mind training of beginning to move our minds into a different direction. And often when people teach or lead these programs, they start with equanimity instead of ending with it, to say, okay, this is where we're going. And other people do it with equanimity at the end. And I like to have equanimity at the end because I think by the time you get there, you're already getting an inkling of what it's about, even if you don't know. I mean, you're working with yourself and somebody close and somebody neutral and somebody that you have difficulty with, you know, wishing them goodness and all that, starting to see that we're moving towards some kind of unbiased feeling. And the Vijayadhara, I don't remember which seminary it was, but at one of the seminaries I went to, he would have somebody look up words in the Oxford English Dictionary. So, like, if he used the word wisdom, he'd say to his kusum, look up the word. So I looked up the word equanimity. I don't have the English, but I have the Oxford American Dictionary. And it says the kinds of things that you think it would say. Calm, peaceful. But also it said, I don't know, I guess I don't have to say it exactly, but having what is the word? God, my mind just cut out. right. Having evenness of mind, even in difficult situations. That's what the dictionary, you know. And I think that points to something. Although I think that our vision is actually even vaster than that. But having evenness of, you know, of temperament, that's what it says. Having evenness of temperament, even in difficult situations. That's the beginning. But before we talk more about that, I wanted to go back to the other three and talk about them a little bit. So we start out with loving kindness. And I thought that Bill did a really nice job of introducing the practice and starting. And he used a phrase that I think actually works with all of them. And he said that the kind of love that we're talking about is the kind of unconditioned love without any strings attached. Remember he said that? And that phrase really kind of resonated with me, without strings attached. So loving kindness, as we say, is making friends with ourselves, as Emily, you know, pointed out earlier, too. Kindness to ourselves, making friends with ourselves. And we say, may all beings enjoy happiness and the root of happiness. And I remembered that one time Trungpa Rinpoche, who is this wonderful old Kagyu teacher, said, when he was teaching about this, he said, well, you know, happiness is a really kind of loaded word. It's usually happiness is very conditioned. Something is going to make us happy. You know, and then once we have that, you know, I remember one time we were living at DKD at this retreat center, and, you know, it was very bare bones. And we had a washer, but we didn't have a dryer. So I had to either hang things out or drive 10 miles to the laundromat. And I used to think, if I had a dryer, I would be so happy. I would never need anything else. And because we were resourceful people and we had a lot of support from our community, eventually we got a new washer and dryer, and I was so happy for about a year. And then it was something else.
Yep.
Then we needed a new car. So Trungpa Rinpoche said, happiness, he said, really what happiness would be is more the idea of contentment, being content with yourself, having some sort of contentment with your life. And again, a story, if you don't mind, this comes from the Insights Meditation Society group that you mentioned last time, Sharon Salzberg.
Yeah.
So this is back in this early 70s when we were all just starting out, and Sharon Salzberg and what's his name? Goldstein.
Joseph
Goldstein, and all of them were, they were in some Burma or some godforsaken place with a Theravadan teacher in this hut with a dirt floor. And they meditate in silence all day. But then at the end of the day, he comes to give a talk, so they're allowed to talk before the talk. So they're this dirt floor hut. They have very simple food. So he comes in, and he says, you know, I've been listening to you every night. And he said, you're never happy. He said, you're always wanting what you don't have and not wanting what you have. He said, to be happy, want what you have, don't want what you don't have. It's so easy. And Bruce and I, that's sort of one of our things. We say that to each other all the time. It's so easy. So I think about that when I think about happiness, that if we could find some contentment in our lives, that we would really feel good. And contentment with who we are, you know, contentment with ourselves. Making friends with ourselves has a lot to do with appreciating who we are and recognizing our strong points and not fretting about our limitations, that kind of thing. So loving kindness has a lot to do. So the happiness, and it, you know, whatever it means for you. And sometimes when I do that practice, I'm very sort of concrete. I think I know what would make that person happy, even though I know it would only be temporary. But I know that kind of happiness, and if that's what they want, I hope that they get it. So, you know, both of those things. And then with compassion, of course, there are the three kinds of pain. And you talked about the first one earlier, the pain of pain.
Yes.
That when you're in pain, it hurts. You know, you fall down and break your leg, it hurts like hell. There's the pain of pain. And of course, we don't wish that on anybody. And if somebody has that, we... But the second one is the one that I think that is really the one that gives us difficulty, and that's the pain of change, pain of alternation, that things are always changing. And we can't really control that. So whether it's suffering because, you know, we're ill, somebody's ill, or, you know, hurt or something like that, or it's just, you know, the vicissitudes of life are painful. We don't like change. And so that causes us pain. That causes us suffering. And then there is the third kind of pain, which is this kind of general anxiety that we have. This generally is called... this kind of undercurrent of dissatisfaction all the time that, you know, that makes us just not feel, you know, feel like something's not right. I know, just some kind of underlying anxiety that is part of the human condition, whether you want to say, like Steve was talking about, karma and, you know, the second noble truth of the origin of suffering being holding on to the belief in the self and all of that. But it's this this kind of undercurrent. So, you know, we can have compassion for that as well as, you know, we can be thinking, just like when you do Tonglen, right, and you pick somebody. We can think of that, but also things are constantly changing and we don't like that. And then with joy, of course, Eric gave us some very lovely examples, right? The little boy with his toddler thing, the bike, and the man with his red truck. The way I think about it is that everybody has something in their lives that's working. You know, it may be something very simple. Even people who are lonely or don't have much, there's something. They have a cat or a dog, or they have, you know, their quilt making, or maybe it's just that they come home from work after a really hard day where they've been put upon, and they have a recliner, and they get themselves some, either a beer or some chamomile tea or whatever it is, and they sit in their recliner and they lean back and they go, ah, now I feel good. Everybody has something that's working. So, you know, joy doesn't necessarily have to be a big deal. It could be something simple like a red truck that, you know, and we don't always know what it is for people, but We can imagine. So those are the things that, you know, that we've been talking about. So then we come to the last one, which is equanimity. And it says free from passion, aggression, and prejudice. So if you have the four people kind of lined up, The idea with equanimity is we begin to recognize that there isn't anybody who's more worthy than anybody else. There isn't anybody who's more, important in a certain way. We have that, I think that really resonates for me in the Shambhala Sadhana, where we say, I have basic goodness, all beings have basic goodness, and then society is basically good. If we have a sense of equanimity, then we can begin to see that that could be true if we have that attitude. And so free from passion means free from desire, clinging, wanting to bring something in, to manipulate, to use, to be jealous, all of these things. So to be free from that. And, aggression obviously is aversion, want to pushing away, aggression, greed. And prejudice is an interesting word, or you can even use the word ignorance or prejudice, of thinking that there are people who are less for whatever reason. And in our culture, of course, there's so much prejudice against this or that, this religion or race or gender or whatever. So being able to be free from those things. And it all comes down to coming back to our sitting practice and all of it. It all comes down to being willing to let go. Let go. Let go and let be. Let go. When the Sakyong talks about equanimity in ruling your world, it's under the heading of the Garuda, and he talks about equanimity as being free from hope and fear. And I think fear is a big one in terms of working with others and having passion, aggression, or prejudice. We're really afraid. Hope, we're hoping things will go a certain way. We're hoping we don't have to see that person again. We're hoping that we do see this other person again, and we have fear. But with equanimity, we're able to just be genuine. And it doesn't mean that we're naively, we're not patsies. There's a real intelligence that goes along with this path, right? There's a real intelligence of knowing when to say, no, or that's not good. But with equanimity, we can learn to be more direct. There's that story about in the when the Vijayadara was teaching at Naropa, he and the regent used to teach these classes together, and they were teaching one on the Bodhisattva Vitarya, and the Vijayadara gave a talk on Tonglen, and Allen, I'll never forget this, I listened to the tapes, Allen Ginsberg stood up and he said, have I told you this story before?
No.
Oh, Allen Ginsberg stood up and he said, people are always telling me, well, you're like this or you're like that, And he said, they don't really know me. They're telling me I'm like this and I'm like that. And he said, I'm not. And he said, I'm not really, I don't know what to do. And so the Vijayadara said, well, you have to just take it all in. And then he said, completely without aggression, without any aggression, you just say to them, well, that thing that you said about me is true, but this other thing you said, that's not true. I'm not like that. He said, and if you do it completely without aggression, they'll hear you. So, I always thought that was an interesting little story. And I think it was Sharon Salzberg told the story of, and this is in the Theravadan tradition, that there was this boat trip. So there's a captain and there's four people on the boat. There's you, you're the leader, and then there's somebody very close to you, somebody you've never really met before, and then somebody who, you know, you don't like. And anyway. So the five of you with the captain are on the ship, and you get into a storm and you're lost. And then you finally find your way back, but the captain comes to you as a leader and says, you know, we don't have enough food and water now that we got off course. We're going to have to sacrifice somebody. Who would you choose? And the person who was a leader who had developed equanimity was really stuck. They didn't know because they didn't feel like any of those people were any less important, even the person. So they probably jumped overboard. I don't remember the end of the story, but that would be what would make sense. They sacrificed themselves. I don't know. But the point was that if you're in a situation like that, if you have equanimity, then you really don't see that there's difference. That, like I said, one person is more worthy than another. So, what's the time? Oh, okay, it's early. So, and I think, as we said earlier, and I think it's always worth repeating, and, you know, and Emily, I know, Shari brought this up when she was talking, that it's always important in doing these practices to be genuine with it and to recognize where you are with it. And there are certain places where we get stuck, certain places we don't feel comfortable. And it's just to acknowledge that and not feel that it's a problem. And from time to time, we actually have a few moments from time to time where it all works. And that's good. That's our starting point, you know. And we just go from there. And maybe next time it doesn't. You know, it's just like when you practice at home, right? Mm-hmm. Some days you sit down and you practice and you go, wow, that was a good session. And the next day you can't stop thinking for a second. You go, what happened? Well, what happened is it's the next day, you know. So it's important to always just be genuine and not give yourself a hard time. And to, you know, like when we were talking with Shari, we were talking about and with Emily, of just putting it in your own words, if that helps you. If loving kindness, if just kindness works better for you, or if love works better for you, or contentment works better for you, that's why I bring up all these words to try and give you some other choices. If these things work for you, make it work for you. You know, when you're thinking about a person who's neutral, you know, you don't know, but you can imagine, you know, like the checkout people. I always think, boy, they have to stand on their feet for so many hours a day. That must be hard, you know. And they have to, you know, and I know from working with at Social Security, working with the public, it's not always that easy. I mean, not everybody is very kind. I mean, we're here, most people are pretty nice, that I see anyway, in the supermarket. But just to acknowledge, like, the person at the checkout person says, hi, how are you, did you find everything? And I would say, I'm fine, I found everything, and how are you? You know, and how are you today? And they say, have a good day, and I said, you have a good day too. You know, acknowledging people. Just not out of any kind of, because you think it's a goody-goody thing to do, but because you really feel some sort of human connection to them. But, you know, the thing about this path is that's difficult. And the Vijayadara said really early on, it's better not to start this path, because if you do, you're going to have to go the whole way, because it haunts you. There's a haunting quality to this. So, and feeling so the poignancy of life. The other day, because I volunteer at the Habitat for Humanity Restore, you know, in Boulder. And the other day, a dog came in. It had, you know, gotten out of its house. It was running around the store, and it came upstairs where we work. And people were trying to figure out. It didn't have a collar or anything. And so somebody put it, because we sell leashes and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, so somebody put it on a leash and walked it in up and down the street, and they couldn't find it. So they took it to the local vet, and the vet said, "Oh, I recognize that dog." But, you know, this dog is running around, and I'll tell you, my heart was just breaking for this dog. And I, you know, and, you know, many of you probably already have that as a natural part of your being anyway. But when you get on this path, for some reason, a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, if you meditate, then you're not going to feel as much, right? No, you feel more. You feel more. It's not always easy. So I really appreciate everybody's path. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say. So what would you comments or questions or additions, or maybe you have things that you'd like to share about how you relate to these things?
Well, I do have a question, which is, I know, like, from the people I know in Iowa and all that, that people look at Buddhists, and we talk about, you know, calm, which, like, equanimity, and how is that different from indifference? That's really, you touched on that a little bit. But, I mean, they, like, I think, I'm not going to be going into the whole thing with Christianity, but they tend to, like, do something even if it's wrong, whereas we tend to not do anything even if it needs to be done. You know, that's kind of the tension.
Is that what people say?
Yeah, it is. Like, they look at the people in the Buddhists in Asia, mm-hmm. and they say, well, you know, they were taught to just sort of accept with equanimity whatever comes along, with indifference sort of, whatever comes along, and just suffer, you know, bear their suffering and not do anything to change it.
Yeah. And do you think that's true?
A little bit, to the extent that, you know, Europeans tend to run around and do stuff mm-hmm. more than, but I don't know. It's not very true. It's not strongly true.
So what do you say to them?
Well, yeah. Well, it's what you were saying. It's indifference is not, equanimity is not at all indifference. It's actually, you're opening your feelings more.
Mm-hmm.
Holding your seat in the face of being rocked back and forth by the different currents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you still, there comes a time when it's appropriate to take action.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, to make a boundary with someone. Or, I mean, like, but you did say we need to be intelligent about it. We can't just be idiot compassion.
Right. Can't just be sort of patsies or naive.
Yeah,
that's
what you said, yeah.
I think there's idiotic forms of everything. There's, like, idiot compassion. There's idiot joy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's idiot loving kindness. I'm not sure about that.
Well, you know, there's a kind of, there's a kind of goody-goody thing.
Or Pollyanna kind of thing.
Yeah.
Be Pollyanna, you know, like, only think of the positive.
Like the absolutely most saccharine kind of Hallmark card, that kind of loving kindness. And,
mm-hmm. I think, it's very easy to see things, you know, on TV or whatever and come up with some idea of what you're seeing without really understanding what's behind it. And there could be. I mean, maybe there are. You know, maybe there are. Maybe the Theravadan monks in, you know, Burma, whatever, maybe they just meditate all the time and they don't do anything. I don't know. Maybe that's their way of... But...
Just to toss it in, of course, Marx said religion is the opiate of the people. And what he meant by that is that it's really designed to let people, to make people not make a fuss and let the rich people stay rich while the poor people stay poor. You know, that's what religion is.
Yeah,
what it's for.
It's political.
It's function.
Yeah.
Is that.
It's making religion into a political thing to to manipulate people. Well, I think you just have to talk genuinely from your heart and say, it's not about indifference. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's about recognizing, you know, what kind of difficulties people have in trying to understand how, you know, maybe we could help, or, but not doing it just because it's the right thing to do, but doing it because some kind of understanding of what's needed. Sometimes what's needed is indifferent, you know, to not really do anything, just listen. And other times, you know, you need to act.
So. Like the story of the people on the boat. They had to make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy choice.
The definition used, even as a temperament, even in difficult times.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about, you know, we had some discussion of the fact that we was available to us, and you mentioned intelligence, and we talked about wisdom and compassion and always being there, and we're making a connection with that, and that evenness of temperament combined with that wisdom and compassion would definitely not eliminate doing something, but it might include doing something, doing nothing, you know, but regardless, there's some evenness of temperaments.
And how you say things in those situations, or how, where you're coming from, that matters so much. I mean, it's like, you know, if you're saying something with evenness of temperament as opposed to like, you know, it makes a big difference. Yeah.
Well, Eric, it's funny that they would say that about Buddhism, because every 2 months you make that trip to Iowa. Fucking Iowa. And you go there and you help your mother. Yeah. And you're helping her with her finances and you're caring about her. And so how can they possibly, you know, can... And so they're saying to you, Buddhism is about indifference?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
I mean, do they know? Do they have any inkling of who you are?
Yeah.
You know, you might point that out to them.
No.
You know, I'm making. No. I'm not. I'm coming here every 2 months, not out of indifference.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that would be a good thing to say.
I mean, it just struck me as being really funny that they would say that to.
That's perfect.
Huh?
That's perfect. And heaven, we talked to Eric, and we know there's. No indifference there.
No.
Anyway.
I think part of it is the assumption that one way is better.
Yeah.
And every culture has that assumption that their way is better.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really see the other. They don't really see.
But they see their way is better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about that, actually, because, like, my grandmother came to mind when we were talking earlier, and, like, she put up with a lot of suffering in her life, and the way she kind of did that was to say, it's God's will.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, and it's, like, beyond her understanding. I mean, it's God's problem, not her problem. And just that gave her some... What looked a lot like equanimity.
Not so much struggle. It's like, well, it's surrender.
Yeah.
My sister does that too. She does this God.
Yeah.
God must want me to be doing this, so.
There's a woman. Another one of my volunteer jobs is at the public library. And there's a woman there that has two boys, and she's homeschooling one of them. The other one, I know because he's autistic, and I. Sometimes work with the OT there, the occupational therapist. Anyway, but her older son, who she's homeschooling, who's a teenager, is also on the spectrum. He's very smart, but he has a lot of difficulty in social situations, so that's why she's homeschooling him. And she said, so I have two kids on the, you know, on the spectrum, she said. She said, but you work with what God gives you, you know. This is what God gave me. And so there is some, you know, kind of possible equanimity in that, of accepting, you know, without, you know, she takes such good care of those boys. You know, she really does. So, well, when we lived in Boulder, we lived next door to this couple. They were retired by then. They had five children. Their oldest daughter had cerebral palsy. And she was now in her 30s, so she was in a wheelchair. And they were Catholic. But to me, they were like the epitome of good Christians. You know, they helped everybody. They brought food to people who were ill. They gave rides to people. And they didn't do it because they thought it was, you know, what they were supposed to. They really did it out of goodness, the goodness of their heart. And, you know, it's funny because I'd walk into their house and they have pictures of Jesus and Mary and everything. You walked into my house, I've got, you know, I've got calligraphies and pictures of the Vichara and stuff. I thought in our own way, you know, our own way, we're... Yeah, so... And if people could just recognize that there are many different ways that that we can... That this kind of goodness could be accessed. It's not... There's not just one way. But like you said, Carol, it's difficult. It's because of passion, aggression, and prejudice, people. But, you know, and people feel like if... Especially in the religions like Christianity, where it's absolutely necessary to feel like, you know, it's absolutely necessary that if you don't take God into your heart, then you're going to hell. And it's really hard for people to understand that there's some other way. Because if there is, that creates doubt. And doubt is one of the real big, you know.
Well, that's why I like Buddhism, because they encourage you
to question.
So I feel honored and respected that way.
But I had a teaching assistant when I was in college. I took this class called The Philosophy of Western Religion. And he was a minister, and he said, we were talking one day. I told him I was a Buddhist, and we were talking in his office one day, and he said, we were talking about faith, and he said, you know, faith is something that I have to renew every day. He said, it's not something that just, you know, I just take it for granted. It's something I have to look at every day. And I thought that was a really good...
It's more alive that way.
Yeah.
But there are people who just try to nail it down. Even in our community, I've run across some of that.
We have plenty of people who... as one person said, leave it in the shrine room. So this guy who used to come down and do retreats at DKD, and he was, you know, he was doing Vajrayogini. You know, he'd been to seminary and done all the nundros and everything. But he was getting a divorce. His wife was leaving him, and he was sort of heartbroken. But he said that she said to him, "You leave it in the shrine room." Because he practiced a lot, but then when he got up and came out of the shrine room, she thought he was, you know, not really practicing what he was, you know, contemplating. So yeah, we have people like that.
I heard this. I said that in here once. Maybe it was at NBC. This prayer, this person said, God, you know, as they laid in bed before they got out of bed.
Oh, I just keep what? What?
Start again.
Oh. Never mind. It's
you lost of, it?
Yeah. It's silly.
Well, I just noticed, you know, like I feel pretty soft until I get to the person that's difficult for me, and I feel myself starting to harden up, you know, like, and I was like, okay, well, you know, and it's fear. You know, it's like fear of this person. I don't feel safe with this person. One thing I learned at Naropa was kind of cool when we were studying psychology was when you feel something in someone's presence, if you're a therapist, whatever, if you're feeling some kind of emotion, just take it as information instead of like believing it. You know, it's like instead of, I don't like this person, it's like, well, this person creates a feeling of dislike when people are around, you know. Or at least I'm picking up on that kind of like, so what is that about this person, you know? And then, so that felt more kind of just like not so stock or something. Mm-hmm. So I was just like trying to, well, what is it about this person that, you know, he does this to people, or he does that to me, he must do it to others or something, you know, just kind of, what is that? You know, just, it felt better.
Yeah. Well, there's that line in the Shambhala Sadhana, in the section on all beings have basic goodness in the, the chanting section that we do, where it says if somebody has caused you harm or difficulty, it's because they haven't recognized their basic goodness and so they act out.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was coming to. It's like, yeah. Oh, of course it's suffering. Mm-hmm. They're suffering because of that.
They have fear.
Yeah.
Or they have, you know, or they come from, you know, they come from a background that didn't allow them to, you know, be able to be open, or mm-hmm. they're defended because they have fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they have these strategies that, you know, these lifetime strategies that are, mm-hmm. that are, that cut them off from people. You know, just, yeah. Mm-hmm. And me too, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. When you mentioned that, leaving the shrine room, that touched me, and with this practice, because I was, first thought about that was, that's, I do too, you know, I often have some kind of understanding and get up and it's as if I didn't have any understanding of this, but this other thing with this practice in particular is thinking that it's a good, it's an opening and expansion of how I can be and how I can wish for others to be. And but I definitely can leave and then as if I didn't even ever do that practice. But there's at least a little bit that I can't ignore mm-hmm. that really gets to me, you know, and that's a gift really because. And I think Vijayadhar said things about that, that is a haunting aspect of it, a bit, you know, because it varies in how much time it takes me to recognize that that wasn't what I was practicing. And, you know, so it works pretty well, really, that, you know, that I may not go out in the world and do it perfectly. I left a lot in the shrine room, but at some point I'll notice that.
Uh-huh. Well, I think it's really important. I know it's difficult sometimes to do, but I think it's really important to read and study and contemplate because it informs. So, like for this practice, I don't know if any of you have seminary transcripts, or if you have, I have the 3-volume of all of the seminary transcripts that Judith Leaf made into 3 books. There's a Hinayana, Mahayana, and a Vajrayana.
We have that,
yeah. Yeah. Well, the Mahayana, the Mahayana, there's a whole section that the Vijayadhara talks about the 4 limitless mm-hmm. ones. And if you have Ruling Your World under the Garuda section, the Sakyong talks about it, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. If you have Pema's book, Places That Scare You, do we have that in the library?
I think so, yeah.
She has a section on the 4 limitless ones. So there's a number of places that you can, you know, read about it and, you know, contemplate it and any of the other topics. So I think it's good to read. And
The point about leaving it in the shrine room, I mean, I think that's one aspect of why we're encouraged to sit for such a long time. Because it, like, even if you come into the shrine room carrying baggage, like you might originally come in because you want to be better than those nasty Christians or whatever, you know, something like that. And then you sit long enough and you kind of see through all that stuff and you're left with encountering the truth. Oh boy. But there you are, you know. And that's why it takes time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To access or to
let it to play out all your
right.
games.
Yeah,
it's a process. It's
softened,
a journey.
Really.
Yeah.
Because we're hardened.
Now, in my case, I can play out games for, like, you know, 30 years. Mm-hmm. Whatever.
Well, you're not alone there.
I think one thing about equanimity that I think is focusing has really helped me with that.
I'll bet it has.
Because I'm realizing that there are parts of me that have been... I've held on to, and they're how could I explain it? I've held on to a part, and it's been just a static constant, and as I've explored being with these parts and letting them be free to be how they need to be, I have more equanimity because I have a greater understanding. So it's something I'm experiencing. A process of becoming more, having more
equanimity. Mm-hmm. That's good.
I was focusing this afternoon with a person who's in my class, and there was a part of me that I was being present with, and I just sensed the true emotion of that part, which I had been, I realized I had just been taking for granted that I knew what that part was all about.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot more to it than
mm-hmm.
I had just been assuming. And so less of the third kind of pain because of that.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about passion, aggression, and prejudice. Passion is holding on to something, aggression, you know, resisting something. And prejudice is like what you were just saying, you know, I have a fixed idea of what this is. You don't look at the possibility that there might be more to it, you know. So,
yeah,
or that ignorance is also like hoping that it'll go away if I don't look.
Mm-hmm.
Those
are like decisions you probably made as a child. And
yeah.
You know, I mean, and then you know, like we take those hurts that we can't deal with, just park them in our bodies.
Yeah.
And those are, they're, you know, we don't even know they're there until you, can, you know, work with something. Yeah, I know. Like,
things that, not only childhood things, but...
Yeah, others. Yeah, trauma. Mm-hmm. Trauma.
And a good example of that type of pain, last night we went to a play, what was that called, Tiny Something?
Tiny, I was telling Melissa about it right here.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tiny Beautiful Things.
And one guy,
really powerful.
They call
at the Dairy Center.
They're doing emails for advice column, you know, they give a problem and then she's volunteered, she responds back to help out with this, and so then he made a play out of that whole thing. It was a book and then a play. But the one guy was good, and his he got a question. He had a funny way of just, you know, getting stuck and being say it, and he says, I don't really have a question, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Just what the fuck?
What the fuck generally? From, signed, WTF.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. Down, like, and, four letters like that.
And she couldn't she didn't answer it, you know, because...
He'd say, generally, and the next one would say, so I mean, universally, and yeah. Sign
It turned
WTF.
Out she let it, she just kind of ignored it a few times, because he had to ask a few times, because he had to get more in touch with his suffering.
Yeah.
And kind of own that suffering, and then she did. I can't remember exactly the answer, but she did connect with it. But he had to actually know that this is his. He had a genuine reason for it. His son had died, is what it was, and was underneath it. But it, mm-hmm. it had colored everything to where it was just general dissatisfaction, frustration. So anyway.
But she also totally had to work with it herself, her own frustration.
Yes,
so she started with, I'm writing this in the most sincere, sweet, hard, or it was kind of a come to Jesus letter, and she said, "It's the fuck is it? That's it, and that's rich, and you know, I mean, her prose. I was telling Melissa the prose in this thing was."
And this was a play.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Tiny Beautiful Things. It's the same woman who wrote that book, Wild, about her Northwest.
Yeah.
Which I didn't think was that great a book, but this one was like.
It was good.
I mean, I have to get this out of the library. See if the library can get it.
There was the same guy who, each of these letters was signed in different ways, and this guy then signed, after he lost his child, he signed it. Signed. Living dead father, it just catches you, just the signature, and then her response was so incredibly beautiful, and said something about suffering, the gift, that it was the most terrible thing in your life, and it's also the biggest gift you've ever had, because in that kind of, because suffering makes us reach. So, I'm here in this room, because suffering, I reached, I mean, you reach down, you reach, sometimes it's for food, I mean, we just reach, and
it was
powerful, yeah, it was highly recommended.
Okay. All right, well, I think that this course of study has been really helpful and very rich. And like I said at the beginning, I really appreciated everybody, Roland and Bill and Steve and Eric, and for the contributions, and to all of you who are here and participating. Like I said, I listened to the tape, so I heard all of the, and nobody's afraid to, there's never like a talk where there's no discussion. Discussion, very good. So I think we should think about, not right away, but in the future, doing another something like this. Because I think it can be very helpful.
I like it.
So
especially if we can come, if there's something we can do that involves a specific practice, that's more helpful than just listening to it.
Yeah.
With the words.
Yeah, well, it's really helpful. I haven't kind of used yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beneficial.
Well, any last things before we end?
Very nice wrap up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa.
Okay. Do you all know the dedications in merit?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the radiant wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. I'm going to turn that off.
Do we have any announcements?